Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke.
All right. Thunder and lightning in Rome. It's the 4th of February, 2008, 0514 hours local time. And this is Solder Smoke 76. I wasn't going to record this morning, but I got up early because of a cold, and then I was just sitting here, and the thunder and lightning started up. It's really kind of rocking and rolling out there, and it just seemed appropriate to do Solder Smoke with some lightning going off in the background. Let's see, hold on. I don't know if that one's making it to the mic there, but that was a pretty good one. All right, let's see. Man, I had a great day. Every once in a while you have one of these great radio days. And yesterday was one for the books for me, and I want to tell you guys about it. I think one of the things that contributed to it was that it was a really kind of ugly day weather-wise in Rome. So none of us really felt the urge to spend a whole lot of time out walking around in the rain. Of course, this led to a lot of time in the shack. And I think I've been telling you about my efforts to get actually on the airwaves from Rome. I finally got the license. The license came through last week. Boom, there you go. The Italian license came through last week, and myself and, well, K1DOS and I were granted the permission to operate in Italy. We're not going to get the Italian call sign, so I'll be operating as Italy Zero Stroke November 2 Charlie Quebec Radio. But it came through, we got a piece of paper, we're good to go. So now I really felt a need to get on the air. You know what I'm talking about. Sometimes you just feel that you got to get out there and wiggle the ether and emit some waves. And I've been studying for the last few months. There you go. Been studying for the last few months the possible antenna configurations here in the house. I've been telling you guys the sad story of my extremely urban location and my potentially very finicky neighbors. So it became apparent that the only way to get out to the universe was via a window that's completely on the other side of the apartment. And I started studying how I was going to get the coax over there. You'll hear more about this in my conversation with EG5RS a little bit later. But anyway, to make a long story short, I went out and bought a whole bunch of kind of cheap cable TV coax of the right color. Color was the important factor here, almost as important as the characteristic impedance and loss dB loss characteristics. So for aesthetic purposes, it was okay, and I got the thing. I got a coax connector. I got a coax lead going from the shack to the window. Boom. Oh, man, this is great. Thunder boomers in the background for Solder Smoke. Okay, I'm not going to get distracted by the thunder. I got the coax to the window. I took a little homebrew antenna tuner that I'd built. The coil is wound on a pill bottle with taps. It's got a standard, 350 microfarad tuning capacitor from an old broadcast band radio. And it's just built on a PC board, Looks really, really homebrew. I like it a lot. Tiny little thing about the size of your hand. I put that out by the window with a little SWR bridge between the coax and the tuner. And out the window, alongside the building, I dropped, I guess, maybe 30 or 40 feet of almost invisible magnet wire. I ran the lead. I went back to the shack. I pulled out the trusty HW8. I love this rig, and this rig is particularly good for this location because, as I've been telling you, I'm in one of the smallest shacks I've ever had. So the very small physical footprint of the HW8 is an appealing characteristic of it. So I fired the thing up, and I did a little bit of running back and forth between the tuner and the rig, and it was very clear that the antenna was peaking up very nicely on 20 meters. This was yesterday afternoon, yesterday morning, probably around 10 o'clock, and there was all kinds of signals coming in. The antenna was obviously receiving very well, and there was some sort of contest, FOC. I'm not sure what that is. I'm sure you guys know. But having been off the air for a while, I wasn't really aware of what the contest was. But I heard lots of G stations booming in. And the very first one I called, G4BJM, heard me just fine. And so I had my first HF QSO from Rome yesterday. I mean, it was really great. It was great to be back on the air. I mean, the internet is nice and Echolink is great and all that, but, you know, it's just not the same. I think we're getting hail here now. And it's really coming down. Anyway, so I made the first QSO and I thought, wow, this is really great. This is about as good as it gets. But listen, guys, it got better. And I'll have to explain. I tried to do a second and third QSO. I had a kind of half of a second QSO with another G station, but I don't think we really exchanged complete calls and signal reports, so it didn't really count. And then the HW8 stopped transmitting. This is a common occurrence. As soon as you get the antenna situation squared away, the rig goes toes up on you, or vice versa. As soon as you get the rig finished, the antenna falls down. It's Murphy at work in the ham shack. And the HW8, which I must say really is in a trusty rig category, started, for the first time in the many years that I've had it, really started giving me trouble. And what it was doing was I'd put the key down, the side tone would come on, it would obviously switch over to transmit, but then it was only intermittently given any kind of power out, which is, of course, not a good thing. And I also noticed that even on receive, even when it was in receive, as soon as it started to have this transmit problem, I was getting a lot of really kind of weird noise on the receiver. And there was something wrong, and it was something that was affecting both receive operation and transmit. Well, you know how it is. I got to get this thing fixed. And now that I just got back on the air, I really got to get it fixed so that I can make some more contacts and use this wonderful, completely stealthy antenna that I just built. So I rummage around I'm really glad that this one particular box made it to Rome from London, and that's the box with all the manuals in it. So I go into the box and I'm rummaging around. There's manuals for the HQ100 and the HW101, for the Drake 2B and the Hallicrafters HT37, all kinds of little manuals for Ramsey Kit, QRP20 amplifiers, things like that. And finally, there it is. There's the old faithful Heathkit HW8 manual and schematic diagram. Well, I haven't been melting too much solder lately, guys, so you know I might be kind of rusty at this, but I whipped it out and I put the schematic out there on the bench. I cracked open the rig and I started poking around in there. You know, at first I thought it would be something simpler. I thought it might be maybe rusty, dirty contacts on the TR relay. I've had that before. So I went in there with sprayed some deoxit around, tried to clean up some contacts. No good. Just I thought it might be something physically loose or something dirty in there, so I gave it a kind of a general clean and kind of, you know, blew on it a little bit, hoping that might do it. Nope. Kind of tapped around with the screwdriver like you do, see if I could spot where the problem is coming from. No dice. Anyway, I knew that the problem was a bit more complicated. And actually, I was kind of pleased by that. I was reminded of a friend of mine in the ham fests in Northern Virginia, that when he'd go in, he'd ask about a rig that he was thinking about buying. If the guy honestly told him that it didn't work, he'd smile and say, "Great, I pay extra for that." Because he'd have a chance to fix it, of course. So the HW8, the circuitry is far from complex, so I figured it wouldn't be that bad to troubleshoot this thing. And I started thinking, what could it be that would be causing problems both on receive and transmit? I started poking around with the oscilloscope probe and checking voltages and everything, and I'm telling you, this was a quick troubleshoot. It was a quick troubleshoot, but it was a pleasing troubleshoot because it was a bit more complicated than a rusty contact on a TR relay, if you know what I mean. And what I found was that the way they kind of mute the transmitter or partially mute the transmitter on the HW8 is that they have a keying transistor, a PNP transistor called Q11 in the HW8. It's just a PNP switching transistor. And what it does is when you put the key down, it puts 10 volts on the collector of the driver transistor, the driver going to the PA. And I was looking at the voltage on that on the collector of Q11. And sometimes on the voltage of the driver, collector of the driver, and sometimes Q11 was putting the required 10 volts on there, but sometimes it wasn't. And it was intermittent, and whenever it didn't, I would also get the noise. And what I realized was happening is the Q11 is supposed to take the collector of the driver from zero when it's on receive up to the full 10 volts when you put the key down. And it wasn't doing either. It was keeping about 3 or 4 volts. When it was bad, it was keeping about 3 or 4 volts on the driver, which meant that on receive, you were getting a lot of noise because there was signal coming through the driver, and it was just creating all kinds of noise. And that's why I was having receive problems. And then, of course, when you put the key down, it wasn't putting the 10 volts on the collector like it should have been, so the thing wasn't keying properly. So all of my attention began to focus on this little PNP transistor in the keying circuit. And it could be many things, and I started looking around for other possible explanations. And nope, the likely suspect, Q11, that PNP transistor. And I started, okay, now you go to the junk box. And parts of my junk box are probably, boom, parts of my junk box are probably still in London or in Punta Delgada or in Northern Virginia or the storage facility in Belgium. Some of it might still be down in a little storage area we have down in the basement. And I was hoping that I would find a PNP transistor somewhere in the junk box here. Fired up the soldering iron and got prepared to perform surgery on the HW8. And I found the PNP transistor, found one in there. I think it was a 2N2907, I think it is. And it's just a standard PNP switching transistor. HW8 is real easy to work on. I popped out Q11, fired up the rig without Q11 in there. course, I wasn't going to be transmitting, but sure enough, the receive problems were gone, so I knew I was on the right track. Took it back over to the bench, put in the PNP switching transistor, the 2N2907. Bingo, man. That thing was fixed. It's transmitting. It's receiving. All the horrible noise is gone. So, I was a very, very happy happy ham radio operator. Not only did I make my first QSO from Rome, not only did my new stealth antenna actually radiate, but I got to troubleshoot and repair the HW8 all on the same day. As you know, these repair and troubleshoot processes, especially if it's an intermittent thing, can be long and frustrating and unpleasant. But this one was pretty painless and very satisfying. So it was a major contributor to a good day. But then even better stuff started happening. I'm going to tell you about this in a little while, but we had an EchoLink in contact with somebody that we've been trying to get on Sutter Smoke for a long time. It's Ron Sparks, AG5RS. Ron is he's working in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates these days, and we both moved this summer. I moved to Rome and he moved to Dubai, and we've both been in the process of kind of sorting out our stations and our internet connections and all that. And just when Ron was about ready to hook up on EchoLink and be able to come in and make a contribution to Solder Smoke, that that fiber optic cable, or those three fiber optic cables serving the Middle East, got broken. So we were knocked off the fiber optic network by the accidents with the fiber optic cable. And and Ron's visit to the Solder Smoke world was delayed. But Ron got the soldering iron out and repaired the fiber optic cable, and and the Middle East came back on the internet, and so did he. So we had our first conversation with Ron yesterday. I'll present it later on in the program, but I hope it's the first of many. But that was also a major contribution to a fine business ham radio day yesterday here at Italy Zero Stroke November 2 Charlie Quebec Radio. And then finally, I came back and I was so pleased with getting the HW8 fixed. We went out for lunch and walked around in the rain just a little bit, and then got back to the house and came in, and I said, now let me listen to this HW8. Now, it's a CW rig, but those of you who are familiar with this fine piece of Heathkit equipment know that if you tune up to the phone portion of the band, it does a pretty good job as a direct conversion receiver to let you listen to phone. So I tuned up there, and then I figured I'd hear some phone stations, but man, there was a station. I mean, I had to turn. He was so strong, I had to turn the RF gain almost fully counterclockwise on the HW8 just to be able to properly demodulate the signal. He was really strong. I knew he had to be very, very close. It was Italy Zero Zulu Yankee Gianfranco, and so I. As you do these days, I immediately turned to QRZ.com and got his address. And then I immediately turned to Google Earth and plugged the address into Google Earth. And sure enough, I discovered that Gianfranco is operating probably, I'd say, just about a half a mile from me. We're in the same neighborhood. We're in the Trastevere neighborhood of Rome. He's right down the street. And the websites indicate also that he's a specialist in big fancy, powerful, sophisticated directional antennas. So, the strength of his signal, I figured he was aimed in my direction. I'm sure we're so close that even off the back of the beam, he'd be rocking the house here at at this end of Trastevere. So I listened in for a while, and then I sent Gianfranco an email and said that I'm very, very interested in hooking up with the local ham radio community here in our neighborhood. And I told him, I said, with his big signal, he's probably going to know all of them. And I got a very nice email back from him, and so we're gonna get together, and this might be my opportunity to get to know the hams here in the neighborhood. So I'm telling you, a fine business ham radio day at I guess we're gonna call it I0N2CQR. All right. Hey, a few things I wanted to cover here before we begin with the session with Ron Sparks. But a couple things. I've been meaning to mention this on Sutter Smoking. Forgive me if I've already done this. We're up to episode 76 here, so I could start repeating myself and start telling stories that I told back at episode 12. It's likely to happen. You guys know how it is. But there's something here. I mentioned Reginald Fessenden's microphone last week, and it reminded me that I've been meaning to mention another kind of amazing bit of technology from the early days of radio. I've plugged many times this wonderful book, Early Radio, by Peter R. Jensen. It's called In Marconi's Footsteps, Early Radio. You can find it at the Gadgeteer Bookstore. And there's links to that off of all of the Solder Smoking Gadgeteer pages. I really love this book. And I wanted to just give you a paragraph here that gives you kind of a sense of what the book is about, while also describing an amazing bit of technology. At this point, Peter is describing Marconi Station at Clifton in County Galway in Ireland. And it says here, I'll read you this one paragraph, and there will be a quiz here. This station was set up around 1908. There'll be a quiz, and you'll be asked to do some calculations. So it might be good at this point to pull out a pencil and paper as the lightning crashes down on Rome. Hope it didn't hit anything ancient and valuable. Here you go. Apart from large amounts of electric power and rotary spark to convert the direct current into radio frequency energy, it was necessary to have inductive and capacitive elements to set the operating frequency. Again, what was involved was of gargantuan proportions. The capacity element was, in this station, constructed as a series of metal sheets, some 9 meters, or 30 feet long, by 3.7 meters, that's 12 feet wide, suspended from the roof structure of a huge hangar-like building with air as the insulating medium. Spacing of the plates was 30 centimeters, 12 inches, and the tops of the sheets were carried on rods with insulators made of porcelain. This was a significant change from the arrangements at Poldhu, where glass plates had been used as separators, and occasional high-voltage spikes would involve breakages and expensive and frustrating repairs. Appropriate, we'd get a lightning strike at that point. A temporary breakdown of the insulating medium at Clifton was instantly repaired without human intervention, but the trade-off was an enormous increase in physical size. In order to achieve the 1.8 microfarads of capacity required to tune up the system at 6,666 meters, or 45 kilohertz, some 1,800 sheets of galvanized iron were required. In turn, The building to house the sheets of air-spaced metal was 107 meters, that's 350 feet long, by 23 meters, that's 75 feet wide, and stood 10 meters, 33 feet high, to the underside of the eaves. Wow, that's quite a capacitor, guys. But here's my question. Is that going to be 1.8 microfarads? That seems like an awful lot of metal for 1.8 microfarads. And I don't want to doubt Peter here, but I've written a book, and I know how easy it is in the editing process to somehow get a wrong number in there. So here's the question. For those of you who are able to make these kind of calculations, here's the elements again. A series of metal sheets, 9 meters long by 3.7 meters wide. Spacing of the plates is 30 centimeters. And they used 1,800 of these sheets. What is the resulting capacitance? And again, they were trying to tune the system at a wavelength of 6,666 meters or a frequency of 45 kilohertz. What would the capacity of that system be? And what would you need? Well, I guess you'd need to know what inductance they were using at. But is 1.8 microfarads in the ballpark there? We'll read some more from Peter Jensen's book next week, because there's a lot more fascinating information in there. Okay, what else we got here? Here's something else that's been a lot of fun. Michael, Alpha Alpha 1, Tango Juliet, is operating at the other end of the of the power spectrum from Marconi's operations. We move now to the from the very big to the very small with Michael's tunnel diode operations and tunnel diode beacons. I reported last week that Michael had the tunnel diode beacon on the air. And it was great fun. Very soon after he turned it on, reports started to appear on QRPL of people who had successfully received the beacon and copied the secret code word. But I must say, a couple of you guys obviously are not too good in the secret code word department, because, well, one of the important words there is secret. So I think from now on, when you copy the secret code word, please try to refrain from broadcasting it on QRPL. because then, of course, Michael has to change the word. But since the first one has already been publicly disclosed, it was Grail, G-R-A-I-L, as in the Holy Grail, as in a theme from a very memorable scene from a Monty Python movie with Michael Palin in it. And anyway, Michael, A1TJ, not only provided an explanation of the origin of the word Grail for his beacon code word, but he also provided a very entertaining YouTube video clip from the Monty Python movie, and it explains, the clip explains why Grail was significant. I recommend it; it's kind of fun. And Michael has very kindly sent us a clip of the beacon as received at another station in New England. I'll have to get the info. I'll tell you where it's from at the end of the clip, but you have to listen very carefully. I think we are dealing here with 120 microwatts from a tunnel diode received across New England. Michael has suggested to me that at this point people might want to use a DSP to figure out what the new code word is. I was able to decode it by ear, and so I think if the if our recording here is transmitted well by Audacity and Real Audio, I think you guys should be able to hear it, especially at the end. In the beginning, it's kind of weak, but hang in there and you'll hear it, and you should be able to copy the secret code word, which I will not reveal at this point, but we were able to decode it here by ear without DSP. Great. All right. Now let me give you the details on that. That signal was 120 microwatts from the tunnel diode, and the receiving station was Bruce N1RX. He was 57 miles away from Michael's QTH. He was receiving with a K2. The antenna was a G5RV at 45 feet. And Michael calculates that makes it 475,000 miles per watt. So fine business. And we try to keep our connections with QRP here. Sometimes we deviate. We start talking about other stuff on Solder Smoke. But there you have it. That's some real QRP. Excellent. A few other things here to mention before we go to the QSO portion. First, I wanted to say kudos to QST. I just got my February issue. It's always it's tough to put together. I imagine it must be tough to put together a magazine like this because ham radio is such a diverse hobby, and it's hard to find something for everybody. And every once in a while, I'll pick up the magazine and say, well, you know, there wasn't too much in there that was interest to me, but I'm sure everybody does. But the February issue had a number of really interesting articles in there. I really liked the piece about the history of the directional antennas. Let me see. Boom! Thunder and lightning. Wow. Hope you guys heard that one. That was a big one. And as a matter of fact, The article that I was looking at that point is in the technical section. It says, lightning, understand it or suffer the consequences, part one. I like this article here. Evolution of the Parasitic Beam Antenna by Peter Dodd, G3LDO. Very fine business. Really good. I like that. I didn't realize that in the early days that when they were trying to move the Yagis, they were not moving them in the horizontal plane. They were moving them in the vertical plane, and they thought that what you needed to do was to aim it at the appropriate angle to hit the ionosphere and come back down at the right point. That was really interesting. I thought let's see what else. Hands-on Radio by Ward Silver, N0AX. I always loved this column, and I've really got to dig into experiment number 61 on the Smith chart because this is something that Mike was talking about and working on shortly before he passed away. And I have never really come to grips with how to use the Smith chart for calculating impedance matching and things like that. But Ward's got a really excellent article in there. And I wanted to note also that in Estrella's column, back on page 66, there's a very nice article with a picture about our friend Rick Campbell, KK7B, winning the 2006 Bill Orr Award. Excellent. Rick, he was recognized for the Micro-R2, an easy-to-build single-signal SSB or CW receiver, and the Micro-T2, a compact single-band SSB transmitter, which appeared in the December 2006 issue. Very fine business, and congratulations to Rick for that well-deserved award. Again, congratulations to the QST guys for an excellent issue. All right, I want to get to the mailbag here. We got a lot of mail this week, and some of it I thought was really interesting.
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
Hello.
Last week I mentioned that I had put on the Gadgeteer page a new, kind of an interesting kind of hit counter for web pages. It's called Cluster Map. And it displays not only the count of how many people who are visiting your site, but it also projects a map of the world with dots indicating where the listeners are. And I think this is great fun. I like to check it every once in a while and see where the Solder Smoke listeners are located. Last week I mentioned that there's one dot on the map that I wasn't sure where it was. And it was north of New Zealand. And because of the way the map is configured on the screen, I couldn't quite see where it was exactly. But I guess that it was either New Caledonia or Fiji, probably Fiji. And, you know, exhibiting here the global reach and awesome power of the Solder Smoke Network, the day after we put that issue on the net, I got a very nice email from ISA, 3 Delta 2 Alpha Alpha. Sure enough, he's the guy under that particular red dot. and he's in Fiji, and he sends a very nice email. He says he's a regular listener out there. He says he works in the electronics field out there, and he says there's all kinds of electronic junk for him to use for construction purposes. He has a stockpile on Fiji of, get this guys, 50 NE602 chips. I mean, we might have to turn to him for some parts help. It's usually the opposite way around. I know from having lived on a remote island, sometimes you have to ask for assistance, but ICE's got 50 602s out there. He's currently working on a project. He's building Farhan's DC40 receiver with discrete components. For 40 meters, he's having a great fun with it. And I thought this was great. He is the first person from Rotuma Island to get a ham radio ticket. Now, Rotuma is about 400 miles to the northwest of Fiji. And Billy has this big map of the world on his wall next to his bed. And the other night as I was putting him to bed, I looked up, and sure enough, right on the map there, just to the northwest of Fiji, is Rotuma. It counts as another DXCC island, DXCC country, and I think our friend Ise might be generating pileups if he brings some of his homebrew QRP gear back to Rotuma. So anyway, thanks for writing in, Ise. I hope I'm pronouncing your first name correctly, but good luck with the project. Keep us posted, and we'll think of you every time we see that red dot. I noticed that the red dot got bigger, so either over Fiji. So other people must be tuning in, and so great. And thanks very much. Good luck with the project. Keep in touch. We also note on the cluster map, for the first time, there's a red dot over Beijing. And great, so that's further evidence that we are getting listeners from China. If you're under that red dot or any of the other more exotic locations on the map, please send us an email and we'll mention you on the show. Roger, Papa Alpha 1, Zulu Zulu, writes in. He is currently living in California, and he's having a tough time struggling with anti-antenna covenants and reciprocal licenses and some of the, security measures that make carrying ham radio equipment around and setting up antennas difficult. So, Roger, you have our sympathies there, and if anybody has any suggestions for him, please send them this way, and I'll pass them along to Roger. We got a nice email from Jerry NR5A out in South Dakota. He has taken a turn towards tube equipment lately. He's building a 6L6 slat transmitter. This is where you build it on wooden slats. I think this is like 1930s or 1940s technology. Excellent. Good luck with the project, Jerry, and thanks for writing in. Ron, N4KTQ, responded to our story about the HARP moon bounce signals. He says that at his location, the moon bounce, the bounces were stronger than the outgoing pulses from Alaska. And of course, I guess that's completely possible considering propagation. And I guess in a way you're saying that you had better propagation to the moon than you did to Alaska at that point. I thought that was real interesting. In the recording that we got from WA6ARA, the outgoing signals were of course a lot stronger. But very interesting on that. We'll have to read more about the HARP experiments. But thanks for those reports. Niles PE1 OIT, he agrees with the statements that indicate that DSB should not be considered useless throwback technology. And he points out that I didn't know this, that PSK31, the digital mode, is essentially DSB. So thanks for sharing that with us, Niles. And our friend Ramakrishnan, VU3RDD in Bangalore, writes in. He's trying to get, and he asked me for help in this, and I was unable to help him. He's looking for a series of articles that appeared in the AMQRP homebrew magazine, the one that came around on the disc there from AMQRP and the New Jersey QRP Club before it. And Wayne had written a series of articles called Nuts and Bolts. And Ramakrishnan in Bangalore needs it. I thought it was going to be on my disc here, but it wasn't, because the disc I had was the one that had solder smoke, so I guess they didn't put the back issues on there. And I gave away my other discs before I left the UK. So if anybody has them and could send them to Ramakrishnan, that'd be great. All right. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. And I hope I didn't forget the gong. Well, we'll work the gong in there somewhere. I might be messed up this morning by getting up too early and the lightning and thunder going off in the background. Now it brings us to the two-way QSO portion of this week's show. And like I said earlier, I'm delighted to welcome to Solder Smoke Ron, AG5RS. And we've been hoping to get Ron on for a long time. I think he's really a perfect guy to be one of our regular visitors here. He was diagnosed with the knack very, very early in life, and I think it was probably inevitable because his last name is Sparks, Ron Sparks. What a great name. I often, when I see Sparks, Nevada, I think I worked somebody from Sparks, Nevada one time, and I thought, what a wonderful name for radio. And so Ron is, like I said, he's now in Dubai. He's a regular listener to Solder Smoke, and we're delighted to have him on. We spoke about an hour and 15 minutes yesterday. I'll break it up into three or four parts, and we'll put it on here. We've got to work a little bit on the audio on both sides. Echolink, it's sometimes hard to get the kind of audio balance and adjustments here properly. We're given the problems that have been out there with the fiber optic cables from the Middle East, we're lucky to have Ron's contribution at all, and we're delighted, as I said, to welcome him to Solder Smoke. So here we go, fellas. Somebody who, like the rest of us, is definitely a victim of the NAC. Welcome to AG5RS.
AG5RS, this is M0HBR. Or I guess I should say Italy 0 stroke November 2, Charlie Quebec Radio. Are you there, Ron?
Hey, Bill, this is Ron. I hope this is coming through clear. I'm now trying it, AG5RS, trying to connect to M0HBR.
There you go. There you go, Ron. Fine. Coming through just 5x9 here in Rome. I guess you got that undersea cable spliced, Ron. Good work there. I was wondering how long it would take you to get down there with the soldering iron. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's kind of tough to solder underwater, but apparently some of my buddies managed to get that done. So now we've got good internet connection, and based on what I'm hearing, the latency's not bad either. So we're finally back up on the Dubai end of things. Over.
All right, real good. I just got to turn up my speaker volume here. Got to figure out how to do that. Hold on. We should have the technology. Let's see. I'm having a tough time hearing this morning. I got a bit of a cold. Stand by. 1 second. There we go. I did it the old-fashioned way. Well, great, Ron. I've got the. Let's see, I'm getting everything set up here, but yeah, terrific. So I guess we should tell the Solder Smoke listeners that where you are, and you know, we're both in the same situation here because I'm not in M0, and you are not in AG5. So explain how the how that undersea cable knocked you off the fiber optic network, Ron. Go ahead.
Okay, M0HBR, this is AG5RS, and I'm currently in A6 land. The thing that knocked me off the air, I guess, over about the last week was that some method damaged the two main links between Europe and Egypt / the whole Middle East with, they think it was probably an anchor chain that got drugged through there, and just once again confirmed my underpinning and overwhelming desire for amateur radio as an emergency response type communications. It really is, when all else fails, amateur radio is there. So, in any case, I am not currently licensed. I am in A6 land in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. I am originally, as most people could pick up from the accent, from Texas, hence the AG5 call sign. And I am working. It's very difficult in the UAE to get an amateur license. They do not have a reciprocal agreement with anybody, and generally non-native-born amateurs are not permitted to get a license. So that's one of my major endeavors. In the meantime, I have discovered Echolink and enjoyed finding a way to set it up and run it on my Linux machine, which is working fine, apparently. AG5RS, over.
AG5RS, M0HBR. All right. Well, my sympathies there. I know that could be frustrating. We just successfully, just this week, completed the process of getting a reciprocal license, actually two reciprocal licenses from Italy. It worked out fairly well. Signs. We didn't get call signs, so I guess we're going to have to operate as Italy 0, which would be the Rome area, stroke, then our home calls. So, you know, as soon as I got this thing, I felt this urge to get on the air. So yesterday I was My wife was horrified because I was tacking down a coaxial cable along the sideboards of our living room. It looks okay, but I mean, I think I can understand her apprehension. But and now I'm planning for completely invisible clandestine antennas that will not alert the ever vigilant neighbors. AG5RS, M0HBR.
M0HBR, this is AG5RS. Yeah, I understand about the clandestine antennas. That back when I was living in the U.S., that was a big issue because there are a large number of homeowners associations that don't permit anything that you could see. And so I did a fair amount of work years ago in developing or designing stealth antennas. And one of them I came up with was, it wasn't great, but it seemed to work pretty well. It was basically just a vertical hung off of the edge of the house down along the side of it. And when you got the links right and put in the proper radials, it seemed to work pretty good all the way down to about 40. But here I'm going to satisfy myself with some of the stuff that I have not gotten around to for quite some time, and I've got the soldering iron set up. I've discovered the marvels of IKEA and how you can take a very small space and turn it into an excellent little sorter smoke lab and work area. And hopefully one day when I get approval from the local government, I'm still hopeful that I will be able to be an A6 call. Typically here, if you do get a license, they do not change your call, so you're A6 stroke. So that's something I'm looking forward to down the road. In the meantime, I have all of the components for a SDR software-defined radio, which came in my luggage, and they didn't seem to object to me bringing a bunch of unbound PC boards. So I'll keep the transmit part off and put my SDR together and let the group know how that goes over the next period of time. M0HBR, this is AQ5RS.
Oh man, we're thinking on the same wavelength here, Ron. I also have a small space here, and IKEA has already made a contribution. Oh, my wife and anybody who visits the shack notes that my furniture arrangement is kind of unusual. I have a nice workbench that she got for me from Home Depot many years ago, and it's perfect. It's the right size. It's the right height. It takes up a good portion of the room, but it's worth it, you know. And then the operating table is actually, and I think it's pretty appropriate, it's a packing crate. I think 3 or 4 moves ago, I warned the builders about the need to protect the Drake 2B, so they wrapped it up in this pretty big box. And when I got to the next location, I realized that if I took one of the sides and nailed it up onto the top of the thing, it made a pretty nice operating table. So I'm operating from a packing crate right now, and I have an old kind of just one of these fiber, what do they call it, fiberboard computer desks that's been bashed and hacked away, and that's sitting next to it, and that's just really just holding up printers and scanners and things like that. But I know what you mean about IKEA, and what I need here is some shelving. So I'm going to go and visit the Rome IKEA and put up some shelving, because that's a critical need. I got a pretty good bookcase over there, which is also an important element. Hey, well, fine on your current projects, Ron, but I understand that you have been diagnosed with a very bad case of the knack. And maybe we should start out by, I guess it's almost sort of like some sort of 12-step program. Tell us when you first began melting solder, things like that. So tell us about it, Ron. AG5RS, M0HBR.
Sure enough, M0HBR, this is AG5RS. Actually, I had the knack before it was diagnosed as a full-fledged syndrome. My parents have a story that they tell that I was always a bit of a hyperactive kid and never did sleep. I think the first time I slept more than 4 hours in a night, I was in my teens. But in order for my mother to get some level of peace and quiet, she put me out in the middle of the garage one day and took an old vacuum cleaner that doesn't work and set me down with it and an old screwdriver and wandered away. The family legend goes that over the course of about the next 8 hours, I completely disassembled the vacuum cleaner, had it in tiny little pieces. When my father got home, they both laughed and went back in to prepare dinner. As soon as they got ready to have dinner, they came out to get me. The vacuum cleaner was reassembled, and my father looked it over and said, looks like it all went back together. I'm willing to spin the fuse. Let's try this. And so he plugged it in, and it worked. I guess that's called being born with the knack. AG5RS.
Yeah, that's a definite symptom. We see that a lot, Ron. Yeah, the being sent off to the garage with the household appliances and a screwdriver. You know, very often the family members are the first ones to notice this. I guess my early diagnosis was when my grandmother, we had all moved out to the suburbs. My grandmother was still living in her house in the Bronx in New York. And, you know, she would come out and spend a lot of time visiting with us, and she was always concerned about burglaries, which was a legitimate concern. And so somebody had decided it wouldn't be a great idea if we got her a timer, just one of these little plug-in timers that could turn the lights on and off at the right time and give the impression that somebody was home. And for some reason, none of the adults in the family could crack the code on this thing. And I got it, and within a couple of minutes, I had it going the way it was supposed to go. It was no great technical accomplishment, but it caused my grandmother to declare to everybody in the family that I was, quote, electrically inclined. So that was my early diagnosis. But then, what were in your case, Ron? What were some of the follow-on symptoms? Go ahead.
Yeah, in my case. Well, first I have to laugh about now because I just put a dawn to dusk timer on the front door by having to take the plate apart and wire it directly in. But anyway, the follow-on symptoms with me is that I started following the TV repairman around like he was some sort of a saint and asking him just insurmountable questions. And I have to say he was a wonderful gentleman. He mentored me for many years, all the way from wondering what that terrible stink was when the germanium rectifier in the TV went out, and what does it do and why does it do it, to the point that he actually gave me my first job as a technician in his radio repair shop when I was about 16. So throughout from under his mentoring, and I guess it would be Elmering, he helped me to start melting sorter when I was probably, second or third grade, which would be, I guess, 8 or 9. I built the first project I'd ever built. And I think it was a light wave communicator. I could talk over a flashlight beam. As long as you weren't too concerned about high frequencies. It was, as you might have imagined, the filament of most flashlights doesn't have a real good top-end frequency response. But, little projects here and there, went in a science fair when I was an early teenager, and then from there on it's just been, finding ways to cope with the knack. It's somebody once said that you can perhaps get nerdism to go into remission, but you can never cure it.
Yeah, that's right, Ron. There is no cure. We can only treat the symptoms. And that's what we do here at Solder Smoke, week after week. Thanks very much for that, Ron. I really enjoyed that that conversation. We'll continue to present the other parts of it here in the next few weeks, and we'll make this a regular feature. Hopefully, Ron will be one of our regular visitors. Regular interviews with victims of the NAC from around the world. Hey, you might have noticed that while I was talking to Ron, it seemed like another station called in. I think it was M0NDE. The reason that happened is really kind of an artifact of the editing process. I forgot to turn Echo Link off as I was doing some of the audio editing on the show. And as a result, when M0NDE called in on the on Echo Link, it got picked up by the Audacity audio editing program that I use. But it had a nice effect. It made it sound like we were really on the air. I only regret that I didn't get a chance to bring him into the conversation or acknowledge him. I wasn't ignoring you, old man. I just didn't hear you. I'd stepped out of the room at that point during the editing process. Thanks for the call. We'll catch you later. And thanks to everyone who listened in this week. 7-3 from Rome.